Welcome back to MP Access. My name is Ekaterina, and today we are here in New Orleans for the Velocity event. And joining me, Renee Longoria. Renee, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You are our favorite guest to have on.
Thank you.
You are also our most frequent guest to have on. So this is not your first rodeo, so let's briefly reintroduce yourself.
Thank you. I practice in Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Montana. And we do all aspects of default litigation. And
you're an attorney.
I'm an attorney. Yes, I've been in this industry for 30 years.
Okay. And what areas of law you said you are focused on the most?
We're a general practice default firm.
Default.
So I specialize in litigation myself. I like to try cases, argue cases before appellate courts, that type of thing. But we do regular foreclosure, judicial foreclosure. We specialize in federal foreclosure. That's something mm-hmm. that we do that is unique from many firms because mm-hmm. I've practiced in federal court since before I graduated from law school.
Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm. And today you're here for Velocity. How is that going for you?
I just arrived this morning. I was on time, notwithstanding a huge storm in Texas last night, so I am totally buying a lottery ticket.
Oh my gosh. Yes, you should. You're going to become a millionaire.
I hope so.
Okay, so since you are in law, can you tell me what is the biggest legal issue that is in mortgage servicing right now?
There's a lot happening. I think one of the hardest things that we're facing is we have technology is fabulous, mm-hmm. and we are learning new ways of doing things that's making our lives easier and more efficient, but at the same time, particularly important here in Velocity, is sometimes the higher tech we get, the further we get away from the borrowers and the asset, and working to close that gap. I think that's the biggest challenge, both from the servicer side, asset managers, and attorneys.
And how has that default landscape changed over the past year?
It's accelerated, particularly in the last year. There's been a shift towards consolidation. So you see, servicers shifting and combining. You see a consolidation within the law firms, et cetera. And that has increased the danger that we see in the gap, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite story to share about over the past few years? Maybe you had some challenges in the industry that you are most proud of to share that you resolved.
Absolutely. So we began probably 5 or 6 years ago using our own receivers or filing our own motions to get receivers appointed when we saw that there were issues with assets, either that they were high income producing, that the borrowers were using the proceeds in order to fund the litigation, or because they were in distress and you saw a real need to get control of the asset, to control the collateral, and to control the end result. We have spent a great deal of energy sort of perfecting and defining that process, particularly in federal court. And the results have been fabulous, and not just for the clients and the towns, because, you know, obviously if you've got a distressed property, that's not something a community wants. But the bottom line results for our clients, resolving things in a manner that isn't just a foreclosure sale where no one knows what's on the inside and the price point is limited because of that fear, that's been significant. We've also had a number of situations where because we were able to get a receiver appointed, the borrowers actually ended up with money that they wouldn't have gotten had they just let it, go to foreclosure. So that's probably the thing that's most unique that I'm proudest of and want to make sure that we use, but use wisely and judiciously.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you're paying very close attention to?
I'm paying very close attention to regulations and legislative changes. We expected that there would be sort of a backlash when the CFPB pulled back, that we'd see more regulations from states, and we are seeing that. So We're absolutely paying close attention to mm-hmm. that.
Do you have a challenge that you remember from that multi-state, you know, navigation? It's probably very stressful also to keep control over five different states.
I like it. I like the states. People have said things to me like, oh, why don't you go to Rhode Island or this state or that state? I really enjoy the states we're in. I literally divide my time physically between Massachusetts and Maine and Montana. Those are the three states that I live in, that I have a bed and, you know, clothes, et cetera. That helps me a lot, actually. And then I will go to New Hampshire and Vermont, which are sort of in the middle of those states. I have a fabulous staff. So, you know, stress comes from the state, from the litigation, of course, and, you know, different claims that are made. But I enjoy it. I enjoy all the states, and I enjoy the people. And that's something we're very proud about. Every state that we practice in, I personally am barred in, and then I have associate attorneys as well. But we live and work in the geography that we practice in. And mm-hmm. that, I think that makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, especially if you have good people working for you.
I do. I'm lucky.
What's the most challenging multi-state issue you had to navigate? Do you have a story to share?
Multi-state issue. Yes. So when the Show Me decision came down, everyone was very concerned about using the judicial foreclosure process in non-judicial states. That was something because of the practice and the nature of practice in Massachusetts we've been doing for years. So in Massachusetts, you've got a non-judicial state, and what happens is the foreclosure is generally tried, or if someone's going to contest it, it's done in the context of the eviction case. That's significant because eviction's quite a bit slower. It's in state court. You know, those jurisdictions are sometimes challenging for lenders. And so we had for years, if we knew we had, especially if we knew we had a high value asset, or if we knew we were going to have a litigated case, we always brought multi-count complaints. And that that challenge and the solution that had already been tried and proven to be effective was fantastic, frankly, because if you bring a multi-count complaint and you not only have your foreclosure count but your count on the note and your possession count, that means it's one stop. You know, you do your litigation and you try the cases before the judge. If, you know, if for some reason one side or the other loses, then your appellate is up to the First Circuit right off too. So it's efficient in that manner too, because it will cut down on your legal spend ultimately.
Are there any common mistakes servicers make when handling foreclosure, you know, documentation?
I think the most common mistake comes from siloing. I think it's really part of our job as attorneys to bridge the gap between the various departments, to understand the significance of whatever happened in bankruptcy versus whatever happens in foreclosure and, you know, eviction or REO. I think that when mistakes are made, it's usually because we don't have the entire big picture.
Mm-hmm. And what role does bankruptcy play in today's default servicing environment?
Oh, it's huge. If you watch the numbers, I've got an attorney friend who posts them every week, and they just keep going up. It is, you know, with the debt that people are holding, it's one of the tools in the toolbox to reorganize, and it can be really effective for a borrower to just be able to, you know, take a minute, take 3 years or 5 years to reorganize, etc. It's a very important tool. It slows everyone down, and mostly in bankruptcy, folks are represented, so they really get the best opportunity to work out a resolution to their default or to surrender the property and hopefully, you know, retain whatever equity they can. And you see some interesting litigation in bankruptcy too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bankruptcy is also a very scary word. I mean, I think for everyone too. So that's another thing I would be terrified to work with, honestly.
So bankruptcy is a safe harbor. bankruptcy, well, first off, from an attorney standpoint, it's code-driven. So there is case law, but there's a code. Bankruptcy is a fabulous area to practice in because you have guideposts and there's a great deal of case law. You can also, you know, attend bankruptcy court and listen to arguments and practice in all of the states that I'm in. So it's really an open sort of a forum to learn what's possible. And it's a great opportunity for folks to reorganize their debt, to reorganize their business and their company, et cetera. But you have to stay engaged. You have to do the work. And there are many plans that are not feasible. And, you know, it can just delay the inevitable. But if done well, it can serve both sides. Honestly.
And I don't know if it will be a very correct way from my side to ask you this question, but what is your favorite case or situation to work with as an attorney in this field?
Oh, that's interesting. I like a good mediation. So in Maine, we have, anytime someone is in the property, our Rule 4 in federal court, we bring over 95% of our cases in federal court. And so if we serve a borrower in the property, the first thing that we do is refer it to the foreclosure diversion program. And I enjoy a mediation where the borrower comes not only with, you know, their hardship or why they are in default, but with a toolkit of solutions, how they propose to work this out. And when that's successful and you can bring that together, that's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. I mean, I enjoy trying a case as much as most litigation attorneys. I think it's interesting. I enjoy arguing a case, but the resolution that comes from loss mitigation that's successful is the most satisfying.
I can't imagine you arguing with anyone. You look too nice.
Thanks.
Are there any bankruptcy-related issues that tend to catch servicers off guard?
Oh, absolutely. We had one this year that was fascinating because it was a non-judicial state. So the foreclosure is final when the hammer falls. So the servicer thought everything was over. We had actually a very contested auction. I believe the borrower assaulted the auctioneer and one other person. So it was quite a spicy auction. But then she filed a adversary case to roll back the foreclosure sale, and to do that by borrowing the avoidance powers of the trustee. And I've only seen it in one other case. We ultimately settled that case, but it was a very interesting case as a matter of law.
Mm-hmm. And how should servicers think about borrower communication from a legal risk standpoint?
So we think of borrower communication from a legal risk standpoint a lot. I think the issue is we don't think of borrower communication as communication just like you and I are having. I think it's really important to listen and to sometimes read between the lines and try to really discern what's the root cause of the foreclosure, what's the backstory, et cetera. You know, there's a whole category of borrowers, who, you know, are, you know, vexatious litigants and whatnot. And sometimes, particularly with AI, that can be a very prolific in what they can file and what they can do. But just getting to the root cause of what it is that they are trying to communicate, I think is the most important thing.
So my generation, I'm Gen Z, by the way,
okay.
We cannot buy a house right now. Everything is so crazy expensive. And I genuinely can't afford one right now. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on the future of Gen Z in housing market. Mm-hmm. As an attorney in default servicing, do you think we're going to have more foreclosure? Because, I mean, people like me would still want to buy a house and then eventually, you know, things get more and more expensive, not just, you know, you have to pay for mortgage, but also for other things. Mm-hmm. And eventually you can't afford your own mortgage anymore. Mm-hmm. So you have to give the house back to the bank.
Right, right. So I have a son that's Gen Z. So I appreciate what you're saying. I think the answer is geography. Many of the states that I practice in, there are affordable homes. There's affordable housing all over Maine, and New Hampshire and Vermont and Montana. It's not quite as affordable maybe as it once was, but when you get out of the greater metropolitan area, there is absolute affordability, especially if you're willing to, you know, roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty and do the, you know, the rehab or the remodel and that type of thing. We're also in a world that many people can work remotely. And because they can work remotely, they can live in Cascade, Montana, or, you know, northern Maine. Mm-hmm. And they didn't used to be able to, but Starlink has literally changed the world. So you've got really good, reliable internet connectivity in the far reaches of rural states. And I think that because Gen Z is really a generation that cares much about your time, your currency is your time, that's where you find your joy and your happiness, et cetera. It's not, you know, how big is your house, et cetera, but you want to be able to get out and to hike, and you want to live in your own house and have a dog. A lot of dogs, actually. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I think that's all very possible, but you have to maybe let go of the expectation that you're going to live in New York City or Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was my dream. Thank you for crushing it.
Sorry. Have you been to Northern Maine? It's beautiful. Come on up.
I've heard, and the weather is also beautiful, too, right?
The weather
it's not
is
like
beautiful.
Humid. It's four seasons.
Yes, at least four seasons, though. Yeah. I've actually lived in Texas, I've lived in Austin. I haven't been in New Orleans for 26 years. I came to argue before the Fifth Circuit here the last time I was here.
Welcome back.
I was young. Yeah.
So would you recommend Gen Zers to, like, buy houses that are for a flip and, you know, make money off of that to be safer?
No.
Or to get a mortgage, like a first-time home buyer mortgage?
My recommendation is always to buy dirt. I prefer a three-family. A two-family is okay. But my very first entry-level home for folks in your generation is a home that they have both their own income and they have passive income. I think that is the best formula for mm-hmm. success. But the key is to really prioritize your spending. I think one of the things that's hard is in general, folks don't use cash much anymore, mm-hmm. and it makes it harder to budget. You know, the $5.96 that you spend at Starbucks for your, you know, coffee every morning, if you don't do that and you save it towards a down payment, you know, you're one step closer. So I think that being fiscally conservative and, you know, frugal with your money and then really investing in something that you can make a difference on. The other thing that's really huge is if you buy a property that needs improvement, that sweat equity, I mean, it's real, and it's very satisfying.
Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Man, I knew I shouldn't have bought my BMW.
So I drive a 2010 450H with a lot of stickers on it and almost 300,000 miles.
What?
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive.
Well, it's my nature. It's to be very fiscally conservative. I would much rather invest in dirt than in, you know, rubber for the road. Yeah. Because I drive a lot, so you might as well just drive those things as far and as long as you can.
What are some of the best practices for documenting communication and loss mitigation efforts, in your opinion?
Contemporaneous. It just has to be contemporaneous. We have a great back office system, and my folks are religious about it as far as, you know, if it's not in case aware, it didn't happen. And just having that system open and making sure that you are documenting correspondence with everyone, with your attorneys, with your borrowers, et cetera, is really important. And I see that happening in the servicer shop. It's good. I often request collection notes. I want to know what's happened the last 6 months, who's talking to who, you know, what's, you know, what efforts have been made towards loss mitigation. Sometimes I find that people have passed, even though, you know, when I do my initial search, they don't come up as, you know, being deceased, et cetera. So the collection notes are excellent, and I find a lot of quality there.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of borrowers and courts, how do those approaching foreclosure cases nowadays, is it any different from how they used to do it?
You mean the borrowers, their strategies?
Yes.
Definitely. Well, and they fall into two categories, your represented and your non-represented borrowers. I think court is always scary for just about everyone, more so if you're pro se. And I think there are more resources, both in the courthouses and online, et cetera. So that helps a lot. It can also skew expectations. And sometimes that is unfortunate, because I think, I guess, the good old days, you know, there was more a focus on, all right, you have this asset, it's worth whatever it's worth. You have this obligation, and it's how far past due, and what's the total due. And there was just a real focus on that. I think now you see a number of borrowers read something online, see something that someone else did, and think, this is going to be great. All I have to do is, you know, A, B, C, and D. I'm going to get myself a free house. I think that's true in most states, but particularly in Maine, where I practice often, it can be an issue. And it can sometimes get in the way of actually solving the problem, because, you know, that a free house is like winning the lottery. Mm-hmm. Well, everyone wants to win the lottery, but, you know, there sometimes is a very workout or amicable solution that would get the borrower current with their obligation. It won't make it vanish, but it will, you know, solve the problem. But that doesn't get explored because they believe, you know, in some of the things that they read online and whatnot. And that's, I think that's hard. Attorneys are very helpful most of the time because they introduce a more realistic set of solutions. And foreclosure diversion or judicial settlement conferences are also helpful for that reason. It gets everyone seated around the table talking about what's possible.
Mm-hmm. And what do you wish more mortgage professionals understood better about the legal side of default servicing?
That's a good question. It's like a souffle sometimes. You know, you do want to be patient with the process. We are timeline driven. I understand there are advances and there is interest and there are costs to holding assets, and those costs are important. And we try to move cases efficiently as possible. But, you know, sometimes there's a lack of patience with, I'm sorry, you argued that in February. My goodness, why hasn't the appellate court given you a decision? It's not necessarily bad that they haven't. You know, sometimes, especially if you're, you know, blazing new trails and answering, you know, legal questions for the first time, and they are an issue of first impression, it takes a while to make good law.
Mm-hmm. And looking ahead, let's say 12 to 24 months from now, what legal or regulatory developments should be in the industry?
Should be?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't think I'm a should-be person. I study. I react. I lobby. There's a lot that I want to happen. You know, it's a balance. It's a system of checks and balances. And my role isn't a judge. My role is an advocate, to advocate for my clients. I want regulation from the standpoint of everyone should color between the lines, but at the same time, not regulation for regulation's sake. I think it's important to really look carefully when we're starting to layer either regulations or new laws and make sure we don't have unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm. And for professionals attending Velocity yes. here today for the next 2 days, what is one practical takeaway they should bring back to their teams?
Well, conferences like this are magic because we do spend so much time in front of our computers, maybe on Teams with other people, but not just live interactions, you know, shaking hands, having meals. I'm looking across the room and gentlemen are shaking hands with each other. You know, just that human touch is fabulous. And sometimes I see at a conference like this, I'll see, you know, heads down on the cell phones and I want to, you know, stop, give it a few hours, you know, just be with the other people. And really listen to their pain points, the things that are frustrating them. This is actually the last day that I have on a tour that started in Montana and went to Texas and whatnot. And I went to see the courts, the clerks, the sheriffs, and whatnot. I do that in the spring very often, some of the properties. And, you know, just get out. And see it yes. and feel it and be with the people and listen to your clients say, oh my gosh, this is killing me. Mm-hmm. And I've in the last few days have had several client meetings where I'm hearing the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I want to hear all that because that's the only way that we can get better is knowing what our clients need, what their pain points are.
Mm-hmm. Well, Renee, thank you so much for your time. We are glad that you are back with us here on this podcast and also in New Orleans.
Yes.
Like you said, it's been a while since you've
been
here. So, yeah, enjoy your stay.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for watching and listening to MP Access. Until next time, stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to MP Access. Stay up to date with daily mortgage news, featured stories, and our latest episodes of the podcast at themortgagepoint.com. Don't miss out. We'll see you next week.